One side of his face had begun to twitch and swell. I watched him light a cigarette, thinking, what on earth is this all about? Some things are just too unjust for words, he said, expelling a plume of smoke, and too ambiguous for either speech or ideas. By the way, have you ever been to the Club Calamus?
I don't think I've ever heard of it, sir, I said.
You haven't? It's very well known. Many of my Harlem friends go there. It's a rendezvous for writers, artists, and all kinds of celebrities. There's nothing like it in the city. And by some strange twist, it has a truly continental flavor.
I've never been to a nightclub, sir. I'll have to go there to see what it's like after I've started earning some money, I said, hoping to bring the conversation back to the problem of jobs.
He looked at me with a jerk of his head, his face beginning to twitch again. I suppose I've been evading the issue again, as always. Look, he burst out impulsively, do you believe that two people, two strangers who have never seen one another before, can speak with utter frankness and sincerity, sir?
Oh, damn. What I mean is, do you believe it possible for us, the two of us, to throw off the mask of custom and manners that insulate man from man and converse in naked honesty and frankness?
I don't know what you mean exactly, sir, I said.
Are you sure?
Of course. If I could only speak plainly. I'm confusing you. Such frankness just isn't possible because all our motives are impure. Forget what I just said. I'll try to put it this way, and remember this, please. My head spun. He was addressing me, leaning forward confidentially, as though he'd known me for years, and I remembered something my grandfather had said long ago.
Don't let no white man tell you his business, 'cause after he tells you he's liable to get shame, he told it to you. And then he'll hate you. Fact is, he was hating you all the time.
I want to try to reveal a part of reality that is most important to you, but I warn you, it's going to hurt. No, let me finish, he said, touching my knee lightly and quickly removing his hand as I shifted my position. What I want to do is done very seldom, and to be honest, it wouldn't happen now if I hadn't sustained a series of impossible frustrations. You see, well, I'm a thwarted... Oh, damn! There I go again, thinking only of myself. We're both frustrated, understand? Both of us. And I want to help you.
You mean you'll let me see Mr. Emerson?
He frowned. Please don't seem so happy about it, and don't leap to conclusions. I want to help, but there is a tyranny involved.
A tyranny?
My lungs tightened. Yes, that's a way of putting it, because to help you, I must disillusion you.
Oh, I don't think I mind, sir, once I see Mr. Emerson. It'll be up to me. All I want to do is speak to him.
Speak to him? He said, getting quickly to his feet and mashing his cigarette into the tray with shaking fingers. No one speaks to him. He does the speaking. Suddenly he broke off. On second thought, perhaps you'd better leave me your address and I'll mail you Mr. Emerson's reply in the morning. He's really a very busy man.
His whole manner had changed. But you said...
I stood up completely confused.
Was he having fun with me?
Couldn't you let me talk to him for just 5 minutes, I pleaded. I'm sure I can convince him that I'm worthy of a job, and if there's someone who has tampered with my letter, I'll prove my identity.
Dr. Bledsoe would...
Identity? My God. Who has any identity anymore anyway? It isn't so perfectly simple. Look, he said with an anguished gesture, will you trust me?
Why, yes, sir, I trust you.
He leaned forward. Look, he said, his face working violently. I was trying to tell you that I know many things about you. Not you personally, but fellows like you. Not much. either, but still more than the average. With us, it's still Jim and Huck Finn. A number of my friends are jazz musicians, and I've been around. I know the conditions under which you live. Why go back, fellow? There is so much you could do here, where there is more freedom. You won't find what you're looking for when you return anyway, because so much is involved that you can't possibly know. Please, don't misunderstand me. I don't say all this to impress you or to give myself some kind of sadistic catharsis. Truly, I don't. But I do know this world you're trying to contact, all its virtues and all its unspeakables. Oh, yes, unspeakables. I'm afraid my father considers me one of the unspeakables. I'm Huckleberry, you see. He laughed dryly as I tried to make sense of his ramblings. Huckleberry? Why did he keep talking about that kid story? I was puzzled and annoyed that he could talk to me this way because he stood between me and a job, the campus. But I only want a job, sir, I said. I only want to make enough money to return to my studies. Of course, but surely you suspect there is more to it than that. Aren't you curious about what lies behind the face of things? Yes, sir, but I'm mainly interested in a job. Of course, he said. But life isn't that simple. But I'm not bothered about all the other things, whatever they are, sir. They're not for me to interfere with, and I'll be satisfied to go back to college and remain there as long as they'll allow me to. But I want to help you do what is best, he said. What's best, mind you. Do you wish to do what's best for yourself? Why, yes, sir, I suppose I do. Then forget about returning to the college. Go somewhere else. You mean leave? Yes. Forget it. But you said that you would help me. I did. I am. But what about seeing Mr. Emerson? Oh, God. Don't you see that it's best that you do not see him? Suddenly, I could not breathe. Then I was standing, gripping my briefcase. What have you got against me? I blurted. What did I ever do to you? You never intended to let me see him, even though I presented my letter of introduction. Why? Why? I'd never endanger your job. No, 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 of course not, he cried, getting to his feet. You've misunderstood me. You mustn't do that. God, there's too much misunderstanding. Please, don't think I'm trying to prevent you from seeing Mr. Emerson out of prejudice. Yes, sir. I do, I said angrily. I was sent here by a friend of his. You read the letter, but still you refused to let me see him. And now you're trying to get me to leave college. What kind of man are you, anyway? What have you got against me? You, a northern white man. He looked pained. I've done it badly, he said. But you must believe that I am trying to advise you what is best for you. He snatched off his glasses. But I know what's best for me, I said, or at least Dr. Bledsoe does, and if I can't see Mr. Emerson today, just tell me when I can, and I'll be here. He bit his lips and shut his eyes, shaking his head from side to side, as though fighting back a scream. I'm sorry, really sorry that I started all of this, he said suddenly, calm. It was foolish of me to try to advise you, but please, you mustn't believe that I'm against you or your race. I'm your friend. Some of the finest people I know are Well, you see, Mr. Emerson is my father.
Your father?
My father, yes. Though I would have preferred it otherwise. But he is, and I could arrange for you to see him, but to be utterly frank, I'm incapable of such cynicism. It would do you no good.
But I'd like to take my chances, Mr. Emerson, sir. This is very important to me. My whole career depends upon it.
But you have no chance, he said.
But Dr. Bledsoe sent me here, I said, growing more and more excited. I must have a chance.
Dr. Bledsoe, he said with distaste, he's like my... He ought to be horsewhipped.
Here, he said, sweeping up the letter and thrusting it, crackling toward me. I took it, looking into his eyes that burned back at me.
"Go on, read it," he cried excitedly. "Go on!"
"But I wasn't asking for this," I said.
"Read it!"
"My dear Mr. Emerson, the bearer of this letter is a former student of ours. I say former because he shall never, under any circumstances, be enrolled as a student here again. Who has been expelled for a most serious defection from our strictest rules of deportment. Due, however, to circumstances the nature of which I shall explain to you in person on the occasion of the next meeting of the board, it is to the best interests of the college that this young man have no knowledge of the finality of his expulsion. For it is indeed his hope to return here to his classes in the fall. However, it is to the best interests of the great work which we are dedicated to perform that he continue undisturbed in these vain hopes while remaining as far as possible from our midst. This case represents, my dear Mr. Emerson, one of the rare, delicate instances in which one for whom we held great expectations has gone grievously astray and who, in his fall, threatens to upset certain delicate relationships between certain interested individuals and the school. Thus, while the bearer is no longer a member of our scholastic family, it is highly important that his severance with the college be executed as painlessly as possible. I beg you, sir, to help him continue in the direction of that promise which, like the horizon, recedes ever brightly and distantly beyond the hopeful traveler. Respectfully, I am your humble servant, A. Herbert Bledsoe. I raised my head. 25 years seemed to have lapsed between his handing me the letter and my grasping its message. I could not believe it. Tried to read it again. I could not believe it. Yet I had a feeling that it all had happened before. I rubbed my eyes, and they felt sandy as though all the fluids had suddenly dried.
"I'm sorry," he said. I'm terribly sorry."
"What did I do?"
I always tried to do the right thing."
"That you must tell me," he said.
"To what does he refer?"
I don't know.
I don't know."
"But you must have done something."
"I took a man for a drive, showed him into the golden day to help him when he became ill.
I don't know." I told him falteringly of the visit to Truebloods and the trip to the golden day and of my expulsion, watching his mobile face reflecting his reaction to each detail.
"It's little enough," he said when I had finished.
"I don't understand the man. He's very complicated."
I only wanted to return and help," I said.
"You'll never return. You can't return now," he said.
"Don't you see? I'm terribly sorry, and yet I'm glad that I gave in to the impulse to speak to you.
Forget it, though that's advice which I've been unable to accept myself."
"It's still good advice. There's no point in blinding yourself to the truth. Don't blind yourself."
I got up, dazed, and started toward the door. He came behind me, into the reception room where the birds flamed in the cage, their squawks like screams in a nightmare. He stammered guiltily,
"Please, I must ask you never to mention this conversation to anyone."
"No," I said.
I wouldn't mind, but my father would consider my revelation the most extreme treason. You're free of him now. I'm still his prisoner. You have been freed. Don't you understand? I've still my battle." He seemed near tears.
"I won't," I said. "No one would believe me. I can't myself. There must be some mistake. There must be." I opened the door.
"Look, fellow," he said, "this evening I'm having a party at the Calamus. Would you like to join my guests? It might help you."
"No, thank you, sir. I'll be all right."
"Perhaps you'd like to be my valet."
I looked at him.
"No, thank you, sir.
I said. Please, he said, I really want to help. Look, I happen to know of a possible job at Liberty Paints. My father has sent several fellows there. You should try. I shut the door. The elevator dropped me like a shot, and I went out and walked along the street. The sun was very bright now, and the people along the walk seemed far away. I stopped before a gray wall where high above me the headstones of a church graveyard arose like the tops of buildings. Across the street in the shade of an awning, a Shushan boy was dancing for pennies. I went on to the corner and got on a bus and went automatically to the rear. In the seat in front of me, a dark man in a Panama hat kept whistling a tune between his teeth. My mind flew in circles to Bledsoe, Emerson, and back again. There was no sense to be made of it. It was a joke. Hell, it couldn't be a joke. Yes, it is a joke. Suddenly the bus jerked to a stop, and I heard myself humming the same tune that the man ahead was whistling. And the words came back. Oh, well, they picked poor Robin clean. Oh, well, they picked poor Robin clean. Well, they tied poor Robin to a stump. Lord, they picked all the feathers round from Robin's rump. Well, they picked poor Robin clean. Then I was on my feet, hurrying to the door, hearing the thin tissue paper against the teeth of a comb whistle following me outside at the next stop. I stood trembling at the curb, watching and half expecting to see the man leap from the door to follow me, whistling the old forgotten jingle about a bare-rumped robin. My mind seized upon the tune. I took the subway, and it still droned through my mind after I had reached my room at Men's House and lay across the bed. What was the who, what, when, why, where of poor old Robin? What had he done, and who had tied him, and why had they plucked him, and why had we sung of his fate? It was for a laugh, for a laugh. All the kids had laughed and laughed, and the droll tuba player of the old Elks Club band had rendered its solo on his helical horn with comical flourishes and doleful phrasing. Boo, 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 boo. Poor Robin Clean. A mock funeral dirge. But who was Robin? And for what had he been hurt and humiliated? Suddenly I lay shaking with anger. It was no good. I thought of young Emerson. What if he'd lied out of some ulterior motive of his own? Everyone seemed to have some plan for me, and beneath that some more secret plan. What was young Emerson's plan, and why should it have included me? Who was I, anyway? I tossed fitfully. Perhaps it was a test of my goodwill and faith. But that's a lie, I thought. It's a lie. And you know it's a lie. I had seen a letter, and it had practically ordered me killed by slow degrees. My dear Mr. Emerson, I said aloud, the robin bearing this letter is a former student. Please hope him to death and keep him running. Your most humble and obedient servant, A.H. Bledsoe. Sure. That's the way it was, I thought, a short, concise, verbal coup de grace straight to the nape of the neck. And Emerson would write in reply, sure, dear Bled, have met Robin and shaved tail, signed Emerson. I sat on the bed and laughed. They'd sent me to the rookery, all right. I laughed and felt numb and weak, knowing that soon the pain would come and that no matter what happened to me, I'd never be the same. I felt numb, and I was laughing. When I stopped, gasping for breath, I decided that I would go back and kill Bledsoe. Yes, I thought, I owe it to the race. And to myself, I'll kill him. And the boldness of the idea and the anger behind it made me move with decision. I had to have a job, and I took what I hoped was the quickest means. I called the plant young Emerson had mentioned, and it worked. I was told to report the following morning. It happened so quickly and with such ease that for a moment I felt turned around. Had they planned it this way? But no, they wouldn't catch me again. This time I had made the move. I could hardly get to sleep for dreaming of revenge. The plant was in Long Island, and I crossed a bridge in the fog to get there, and came down in a stream of workers. Ahead of me, a huge electric sign announced its message through the drifting strands of fog. Keep America pure with Liberty paints. Flags were fluttering in the breeze from each of a maze of buildings below the sign. And for a moment it was like watching some vast patriotic ceremony from a distance. But no shots were fired and no bugles sounded. I hurried ahead with the others through the fog. I was worried, since I had used Emerson's name without his permission, but when I found my way to the personnel office, it worked like magic. I was interviewed by a little droopy-eyed man named Mr. McDuffie, and sent to work for a Mr. Kimbrough. An office boy came along to direct me.
If Kimbrough needs him, McDuffie told the boy, come back and have his name entered on the shipping department's payroll.
It's tremendous, I said as we left the building. It looks like a small city.
It's big, all right, he said. We're one of the biggest outfits in the business. Make a lot of paint for the government.
We entered one of the buildings now and started down a pure white hall.
You better leave your things in the locker room, he said, opening a door through which I saw a room with low wooden benches and rows of green lockers.
There were keys in several of the locks, and he selected one for me.
Put your stuff in there and take the key, he said.
Dressing, I felt nervous. He sprawled with one foot on a bench, watching me closely as he chewed on a match stem. Did he suspect that Emerson hadn't sent me?
They had a new racket around here, he said,
twirling the match between his finger and thumb. There was a note of insinuation in his voice, and I looked up from tying my shoe, breathing with conscious evenness. What kind of racket, I said.
Oh, you know, the wise guys, firing the regular guys and putting on you colored college boys. Pretty smart, he said. That way they don't have to pay union wages.
How did you know I went to college, I said.
Oh, there's about six of you guys out here already. Some up in the testing lab. Everybody knows about that.
But I had no idea that was why I was hired, I said.
Forget it, Mac, he said. It's not your fault. You new guys don't know the score. Just like the union says, it's the wise guys in the office. They're the ones who make the scabs out of you. Hey, we better hurry.
We entered a long, shed-like room in which I saw a series of overhead doors along one side and a row of small offices on the other. I followed the boy down an aisle between endless cans, buckets and drums labeled with the company's trademark, a screaming eagle. The paint was stacked in neatly pyramided lots along the concrete floor. Then, starting into one of the offices, the boy stopped short and grinned.
Listen to that.
Someone inside the office was swearing violently over the telephone. Who's that? I asked. He grinned.
Your boss, the terrible Mr. Kimbrough. We call him Colonel, but don't let him catch you.
I didn't like it. The voice was raving about some failure of the laboratory, and I felt a swift uneasiness. I didn't like the idea of starting to work for a man who was in such a nasty mood. Perhaps he was angry at one of the men from the school, and that wouldn't make him feel too friendly toward me.
Let's go in, the boy said. I've got to get back.
As we entered, the man slammed down the phone and picked up some papers.
Mr. McDuffie wants to know if you can use this new man, the boy said.
You're damn right I can use him.
The voice trailed off, the eyes above the stiff military mustache going hard.
Well, can you use him? The boy said. I gotta go make out his card.
Okay, the man said finally. I can use him. I gotta. What's his name?
The boy read my name off a card.
All right, he said. You go right to work. And you, he said to the boy, get the hell out of here before I give you a chance to earn some of the money wasted on you every payday.
Ah, go on, you slave driver, the boy said, dashing from the room.
Reddening, Kimbrough turned to me.
Come along, let's get going.
I followed him into the long room where the lots of paint were stacked along the floor beneath numbered markers that hung from the ceiling. Toward the rear, I could see two men unloading heavy buckets from a truck, stacking them neatly on a low loading platform.
"Now get this straight," Kimbrough said gruffly. "This is a busy department, and I don't have time to repeat things. You have to follow instructions, and you're going to be doing things you don't understand, so get your orders the first time and get them right. I won't have time to stop and explain everything. You have to catch on by doing exactly what I tell you. You got that?"
I nodded, noting his voice became louder when the men across the floor stopped to listen.
"All right," he said, picking up several tools. "Now, come over here."
"He's Kimbrough," one of the men said. I watched him kneel and open one of the buckets, stirring a milky brown substance. A nauseating stench arose. I wanted to step away, but he stirred it vigorously until it became glossy white. Holding the spatula like a delicate instrument and studying the paint as it laced off the blade back into the bucket, Kimbrough frowned.
"Damn those laboratory blubberheads to hell! There's got to be dope put in every single son-of-a-bitchin' bucket! And that's what you're going to do, and it's got to be put in so it can be trucked out of here before 11:30.
He handed me a white enamel graduate and what looked like a battery hydrometer.
"The idea is to open each bucket and put in 10 drops of this stuff," he said. "Then you stir it till it disappears. After it's mixed, you take this brush and paint out a sample on one of these."
He produced a number of small rectangular boards and a small brush from his jacket pocket.
"You understand?"
Yes, sir. But when I looked into the white graduate, I hesitated. The liquid inside was dead black. Was he trying to kid me?
"What's wrong?"
"I don't know, sir. I don't want to start by asking a lot of stupid questions, but do you know what's in this graduate?" His eyes snapped.
"You're damn right I know,"
he said.
"You just do what you're told."
I just wanted to make sure, sir, I said.
"Look,"
he said, drawing in his breath with an exaggerated show of patience.
"Take the dropper and fill it full. Go on, do it."
I filled it.
"Now, measure 10 drops into the paint. There, that's it. Not too goddamn fast. Now, you want no more than 10 and no less."
Slowly I measured the glistening black drops, seeing them settle upon the surface and become blacker still, spreading suddenly out to the edges.
"That's it. That's all you have to do," he said. "Never mind how it looks, that's my worry. You just do what you're told and don't try to think about it. When you've done 5 or 6 buckets, come back and see if the samples are dry. And hurry, we've got to get this batch back off to Washington by 11:30.
I worked fast, but carefully. With a man like this Kimbrough, the least thing done incorrectly would cause trouble. So I wasn't supposed to think. To hell with him. Just a flunky, a northern redneck, a Yankee cracker. I mixed the paint thoroughly, then brushed it smoothly on one of the pieces of board, careful that the brushstrokes were uniform. Struggling to remove an especially difficult cover, I wondered if the same Liberty paint was used on the campus, or if this optic white was something made exclusively for the government. Perhaps it was of a better quality, a special mix. And in my mind, I could see the brightly trimmed and freshly decorated campus buildings as they appeared on spring mornings, after the fall painting and the light winter snows, with a cloud riding over and a darting bird above, framed by the trees and encircling vines. The buildings had always seemed more impressive because they were the only buildings to receive regular paintings. Usually the nearby houses and cabins were left untouched to become the dull-grained gray of weathered wood. And I remembered how the splinters in some of the boards were raised from the grain by the wind, the sun and the rain, until the clapboards shone with a satiny, silvery, silverfish sheen, like Trueblood's cabin or the Golden Day. The Golden Day had once been painted white. Now its paint was flaking away with the years, the scratch of a finger being enough to send it showering down. Damn that Golden Day. But it was strange how life connected up, because I had carried Mr. Norton to the old run-down building with rotting paint. I was here. If, I thought, one could slow down his heartbeats and memory to the tempo of the black drops falling so slowly into the bucket, yet reacting so swiftly, it would seem like a sequence in a feverish dream. I was so deep in reverie that I failed to hear Kimbrough approach.
"How's it coming?"
he said, standing with hands on his hips. All right, sir.
Let's see,
he said, selecting a sample and running his thumb across the board.
That's it. As white as George Washington's Sunday go-to-meeting wig. And as sound as the almighty dollar. That's paint, he said proudly. That's paint that'll cover just about anything.
He looked as though I had expressed a doubt, and I hurried to say, wait, it's certainly white, all right.
White? It's the purest white that can be found. Nobody makes a paint any whiter. This batch right here is heading for a national monument.
I see, I said, quite impressed. He looked at his watch.
Just keep it up, he said. If I don't hurry, I'll be late for the production conference. Say, you're nearly out of dope. You better go in the tank room and refill it. And don't waste any time. I've got to go.
He shot away without telling me where the tank room was. It was easy to find, but I wasn't prepared for so many tanks. There were 7, each with a puzzling code stenciled on it. It's just like Kimbrough not to tell me, I thought. You can't trust any of them. Well, it doesn't matter. I'll pick the tank from the contents of the drip cans hanging from the spigots. But while the first 5 tanks contained clear liquids that smelled like turpentine, the last 2 both contained something black like the dope, but with different codes. So I had to make a choice. Selecting the tank with the drip can that smelled most like the dope, I filled the graduate, congratulating myself for not having to waste time until Kimbrough returned. The work went faster now, the mixing easier. The pigment and heavy oils came free of the bottom much quicker. And when Kimbrough returned, I was going at top speed.
How many have you finished?
He asked. About 75, I think, sir. I lost count.
That's pretty good, but not fast enough. They've been putting pressure on me to get this stuff out. Here, I'll give you a hand.
They must have given him hell, I thought, as he got grunting to his knees and began removing covers from the buckets. But he had hardly started when he was called away. When he left, I took a look at the last bunch of samples and got a shock. Instead of the smooth, hard surface of the first, they were covered with a sticky goo through which I could see the grain of the wood. What on earth had happened? The paint was not as white and glossy as before. It had a gray tinge. I stirred it vigorously and grabbed a rag, wiping each of the boards clean, then made a new sample of each bucket. I grew panicky lest Kimbrough return before I finished. Working feverishly, I made it, but since the paint required a few minutes to dry, I picked up 2 finished buckets and started lugging them over to the loading platform. I dropped them with a thump as the voice rang out behind me. It was Kimbrough.
What the hell?
He yelled, smearing his finger over one of the samples.
This stuff's still wet!
I didn't know what to say. He snatched up several of the later samples, smearing them and letting out a groan.
Oh, of all the things to happen to me! First they take away all my good men, and then they send me you! What'd you do to it?
Nothing, sir. I followed your directions, I said defensively. I watched him peer into the graduate, lifting the dropper and sniffing it, his face glowing with exasperation.
Who the hell gave you this?
No one.
Then where'd you get it?
From the tank room. Suddenly he dashed for the tank room, sloshing the liquid as he ran. I thought, oh, hell. And before I could follow, he burst out of the door in a frenzy.
You took the wrong tank, he shouted. What the hell, you trying to sabotage the company? That stuff wouldn't work in a million years. It's remover. Concentrated remover. Don't you know the difference?
No, sir, I don't. It looked the same to me. I didn't know what I was using, and you didn't tell me. I was trying to save time and took what I thought was right.
But why this one?
Because it smelled the same, I began.
Smelled, he roared. God damn it! Don't you know you can't smell shit around all those fumes? Come on to my office!
I was torn between protesting and pleading for fairness. It was not all my fault, and I didn't want the blame. But I did wish to finish out the day. Throbbing with anger, I followed, listening as he called personnel.
Hello? Mac? Mac, this is Kimbrough. It's about this fellow you sent me this morning. I'm sending him in to pick up his pay. What did he do? He doesn't satisfy me, that's what. I don't like his work. So the old man has to have a report. So what? Make one. Tell him, goddammit, this fellow ruined a batch of government stuff. Hey? No, don't tell him that. Listen, Mac, you got anyone else out there? Okay, forget it.
He crashed down the phone and swung toward me.
I swear, I don't know why they hire you fellas. You just don't belong in a paint plant. Come on.
Bewildered, I followed him into the tank room, yearning to quit and tell him to go to hell. But I needed the money. And even though this was the North, I wasn't ready to fight unless I had to. Here, I'd be one against how many? I watched him empty the graduate back into the tank and noted carefully when he went to another marked SKA-369-TY and refilled it. Next time, I would know.
Now, for God's sake, he said, handing me the graduate, be careful and try to do the job right. And if you don't know what to do, ask somebody. I'll be in my office.
I returned to the buckets, my emotions whirling. Kimbrough had forgotten to say what was to be done with the spoiled paint. Seeing it there, I was suddenly seized by an angry impulse, and filling the dropper with fresh dope, I stirred 10 drops into each bucket and pressed home the covers. Let the government worry about that, I thought, and started to work on the unopened buckets. I stirred until my arm ached and painted the samples as smoothly as I could, becoming more skillful as I went along. When Kimbrough came down the floor and watched, I glanced up silently and continued stirring.
How is it?
He said, frowning. I don't know, I said, picking up a sample and hesitating.
Well?
It's nothing. A speck of dirt, I said, standing and holding out the sample, a tightness growing within me. Holding it close to his face, he ran his fingers over the surface and squinted at the texture.
That's more like it, he said. That's the way it ought to be.
I watched with a sense of unbelief as he rubbed his thumb over the sample, handed it back, and left without a further word. I looked at the painted slab. It appeared the same. A gray tinge glowed through the whiteness, and Kimbrough had failed to detect it. I stared for about a minute, wondering if I were seeing things, inspected another and another. All were the same, a brilliant white diffused with gray. I closed my eyes for a moment and looked again, and still, no change. Well, I thought, as long as he's satisfied. But I had a feeling that something had gone wrong, something far more important than the paint, that either I had played a trick on Kimbrough or he, like the trustees and Bledsoe, was playing one on me. When the truck backed up to the platform, I was pressing the cover on the last bucket, and there stood Kimbrough above me.
Let's see your samples, he said.
I reached, trying to select the whitest, as the blue-shirted truckman climbed through the loading door.
How about it, Kimbrough, one of them said. Can we get started?
Just a minute now, he said,
studying the sample.
Just a minute!
I watched him nervously, waiting for him to throw a fit over the gray tinge and hating myself for feeling nervous and afraid. What would I say? But now he was turning to the truckman.
All right, boys, get the hell out of here. And you, he said to me, go see McDuffie. You're through.
I stood there, staring at the back of his head, at the pink neck beneath the cloth cap and the iron gray hair. So he'd let me stay only to finish the mixing. I turned away. There was nothing that I could do. I cursed him all the way to the personnel office. Should I write the owners about what had happened? Perhaps they didn't know that Kimbrough was having so much to do with the quality of the paint. Perhaps that is how things are done here, I thought. Perhaps the real quality of the paint is always determined by the man who ships it rather than by those who mix it. Ah, to hell with the whole thing. I'll find another job. But I wasn't fired. McDuffie sent me to the basement of Building Number 2 on a new assignment.
When you get down there, just tell Brockway that Mr. Sparlin insists that he have an assistant. You do whatever he tells you.
What is that name again, sir, I said.
Lucius Brockway, he said. He's in charge.
It was a deep basement, 3 levels underground. I pushed upon a heavy metal door marked Danger, and descended into a noisy, dimly lit room. There was something familiar about the fumes that filled the air, and I had just thought, pine, when a high-pitched Negro voice rang out above the machine sounds.
Who you looking for down here?
I'm looking for the man in charge, I called, straining to locate the voice.
You talking to him? What you want?
The man who moved out of the shadow and looked at me sullenly was small, wiry, and very natty in his dirty overalls. And as I approached him, I saw his drawn face and the cottony white hair showing beneath his tight, striped engineer's cap. His manner puzzled me. I couldn't tell whether he felt guilty about something himself or thought I had committed some crime. I came closer, staring.
He was barely 5 feet tall, his overalls looking now as though he had been dipped in pitch.
All right, he said. I'm a busy man. What you want?
I'm looking for Lucius, I said. He frowned.
That's me. And don't come calling me by my first name. To you and all like you, I'm Mr. Brockway.
You? I began.
Yeah, me. Who sent you down here anyway?
The personnel office, I said. I was told to tell you that Mr. Sparlin said for you to be given an assistant.
Assistant, he said. I don't need no damn assistant. Old man Sparlin must think I'm getting old as him. Here I've been running things by myself all these years, and now they keep trying to send me some assistant. You get on back up there and tell them that when I want an assistant, I'll ask for one.
I was so disgusted to find such a man in charge that I turned without a word and started back up the stairs. First Kimbrough, I thought, and now this old...
Hey, wait a minute.
I turned, seeing him beckon.
Come on back here a minute,
he called, his voice cutting sharply through the roar of the furnaces. I went back, seeing him remove a white cloth from his hip pocket and wipe the glass face of a pressure gauge, then bend close to squint at the position of the needle.
Here,
he said, straightening and handing me the cloth.
You can stay till I get in touch with the old man. These here have to be kept clean so's I can see how much pressure I'm getting.
I took the cloth without a word and began rubbing the glasses. He watched me critically.
What's your name?
He said. I told him, shouting it in the roar of the furnaces.
Wait a minute,
he called, going over and turning a valve in an intricate network of pipes. I heard the noise rise to a higher, almost hysterical pitch, somehow making it possible to hear without yelling, our voices moving blurrily underneath. Returning, he looked at me sharply, his withered face an animated black walnut with shrewd, reddish eyes.
This here is the first time they ever sent me anybody like you,
he said as though puzzled.
That's how come I call you back. Usually they sends down some young white fellow who thinks he's gonna watch me a few days and ask me a heap of questions and then take over. Some folks is too damn simple to even talk about,
he said, grimacing and waving his hand in a violent gesture of dismissal.
You an engineer,
he said, looking quickly at me. An engineer?
Yeah, that's what I asked you,
he said challengingly. Why, no, sir, I'm no engineer.
You sure?
Of course I'm sure. Why shouldn't I be? He seemed to relax.
That's all right, then. I have to watch them personnel fellows. One of them thinks he's going to get me out of here when he ought to know by now he's wasting his time. Lucius Brockway not only intends to protect himself, he knows how to do it. Everybody knows I've been here since there's been a here. Even helped dig the first foundation. The old man hired me, nobody else, and by God, it'll take the old man to fire me.
I rubbed away at the gauges, wondering what had brought on this outburst, and was somewhat relieved that he seemed to hold nothing against me personally.
Where did you go to school, he said.
I told him.
Is that so? What you learning down there?
Just general subjects, regular college course, I said.
Mechanics?
Oh, no, nothing like that. Just a liberal arts course. No trades.
Is that so?
He said doubtfully. Then suddenly,
how much pressure I got on that gauge right there? Which, you see it, he pointed. That one right there.
I looked, calling off, 43 2/10 pounds.
That's right,
he squinted at the gauge and back at me.
Where you learn to read a gauge so good?
In my high school physics class. It's like reading a clock.
They teach you that in high school?
That's right.
Well, that's going to be one of your jobs. These here gauges have to be checked every 15 minutes. You ought to be able to do that.
I think I can, I said.
Some can, some can't. By the way, who hired you?
Mr. McDuffie, I said, wondering why all the questions.
Yeah? Then where you been all morning?
I was working over in building number one.
Ha! That there's a heap of building. Whereabouts?
For Mr. Kimbrough.
I see. I know they oughtn't to be hiring anybody this late in the day. What Kimbrough have you doing?
Putting dope in some paint that went bad, I said, wearily, annoyed with all the questions. His lips shot out belligerently.
What paint went bad?
I think it was some for the government. He cocked his head.
I wonder how come nobody said nothing to me about it,
he said thoughtfully.
Was it in buckets or them little bitty cans?
Buckets.
Oh, that ain't so bad. Them little ones is a heap of work.
He gave a high, dry laugh.
How you hear about this job?
He snapped suddenly, as though trying to catch me off guard. Look, I said slowly, a man I know told me about the job. McDuffie hired me. I worked this morning for Mr. Kimbrough, and I was sent to you by Mr. McDuffie. His face tightened.
You friends to one of those colored fellows?
Who?
Up in the lab.
No, I said. Anything else you want to know? He gave me a long, suspicious look and spat upon a hot pipe, causing it to steam furiously. I watched him remove a heavy engineer's watch from his breast pocket and squint at the dial importantly, then turn to check it with an electric clock that glowed from the wall.
You keep on wiping them gauges, he said. I got to look at my soup. And look here.
He pointed to one of the gauges.
I want you to keep a specially sharp eye on this here, son of a bitch. The last couple of days, he's developed a habit of building up too fast. Causes me a heap of trouble. You see him getting past 75, you yell, and yell loud.
He went back into the shadows, and I saw a shaft of brightness mark the opening of a door. Running the rag over a gauge, I wondered how an apparently uneducated old man could gain such a responsible job. He certainly didn't sound like an engineer. Yet, he alone was on duty. And you could never be sure, for at home, an old man employed as a janitor at the waterworks was the only one who knew the location of all the water mains. He had been employed at the beginning, before any records were kept, and actually functioned as an engineer, though he drew a janitor's pay. Perhaps this old Brockway was protecting himself from something. After all, there was antagonism to our being employed. Maybe he was dissimulating, like some of the teachers at the college, who, to avoid trouble, when driving through the small surrounding towns, wore chauffeur caps and pretended that their cars belonged to white men. But why was he pretending with me? And what was his job? I looked around me. It was not just an engine room, I knew, for I had been in several, the last at college. It was something more. For one thing, the furnaces were made differently, and the flames that flared through the cracks of the fire chambers were too intense and too blue. And there were the odors. No, he was making something down here. Something that had to do with paint, and probably something too filthy and dangerous for white men to be willing to do even for money. It was not paint, because I had been told that the paint was made on the floors above, where passing through I had seen men in splattered aprons working over large vats filled with whirling pigment. One thing was certain. I had to be careful with this crazy Brockway. He didn't like my being here. And there he was, entering the room now from the stairs.
"How's it going?"
he asked. "All right," I said. "Only it seems to have gotten louder."
"Oh, it gets pretty loud down here, all right. This here's the uproar department. And I'm in charge. Did she go over the mark?"
"No, it's holding steady," I said.
"That's good. I've been having plenty of trouble with it lately. Have to bust it down and give it a good going over as soon as I can get the tank clear."
Perhaps he is the engineer, I thought, watching him inspect the gauges and go to another part of the room to adjust a series of valves. Then he went and said a few words into a wall phone and called me, pointing to the valves.
"I'm fixing to shoot it to him upstairs," he said gravely. "When I give you the signal, I want you to turn them wide open. And when I give you the second signal, I want you to close them up again. Start with this here red one and work right straight across."
I took my position and waited as he took a stand near the gauge.
"Let it go," he called.
I opened the valves, hearing the sound of liquids rushing through the huge pipes. At the sound of a buzzer, I looked up.
"Start closing it, yeah? What are you looking at? Close them valves." "What's wrong with you?"
he asked when the last valve was closed. "I expected you to call."
"I said I'd signal you. Can't you tell the difference between a signal and a call? Hell, I buzzed you." "You don't want to do that no more. When I buzz you, I want you to do something and do it quick."
"You're the boss," I said sarcastically.
"You mighty right I'm the boss, and don't forget it. Now come on back here. We got work to do."
We came to a strange-looking machine consisting of a huge set of gears connecting to a series of drum-like rollers. Brockway took a shovel and scooped up a load of brown crystals from a pile on the floor, pitching them skillfully into a receptacle on top of the machine.
"Grab a scoop and let's get going," he ordered briskly. "You ever done this before?"
he asked as I scooped into the pile. "It's been a long time," I said. "What is this material?" He stopped shoveling and gave me a long, black stare, then returned to the pile, his scoop ringing on the floor. "You'll have to remember not to ask this suspicious old bastard any questions," I thought, scooping into the brown pile. Soon I was perspiring freely. My hands were sore and I began to tire. Brockway watched me out of the corner of his eye, snickering noiselessly.
"You don't want to overwork yourself, young fella," he said blandly.
"I'll get used to it," I said, scooping up a heavy load.
"Oh, show, he said, show, but you better take a rest when you get tired."
I didn't stop. I piled on the material until he said,
"That there's the scoop we've been trying to find. That's what we want. You better stand back a little, 'cause I'm fixing to start her up."
I backed away, watching him go over and push a switch. Shuddering into motion, the machine gave a sudden scream like a circular saw and sent a tattoo of sharp crystals against my face. I moved clumsily away, seeing Brockway grin like a dried prune. Then, with the dying hum of the furiously whirling drums, I heard the grains sifting lazily in the sudden stillness, sliding sand-like down the chute into the pot underneath. I watched him go over and open a valve. A sharp new smell of oil arose.
"Now she's all set to cook down. All we got to do is put the fire to her," he said, pressing a button on something that looked like the burner of an oil furnace.
There was an angry hum, followed by a slight explosion that caused something to rattle. I could hear a low roaring begin.
"Know what that's going to be when it's cooked?"
"No, sir," I said.
"Well, that's going to be the guts, what they call the vehicle of the paint. Least it will be by the time I get through putting other stuff with it."
"But I thought the paint was made upstairs."
"Nah, they just mixes in the color, make it look pretty. Right down here is where the real paint is made. Without what I do, they couldn't do nothing. They'd be making bricks without straw. And not only do I make up the base, I fixes the varnishes and lots of the oils, too."
"So that's it," I said. "I was wondering what you did down here."
"A whole lot of folks wonders about that without getting anywhere. But as I was saying, can't a single doggone drop of paint move out of the factory less than it comes through Lucius Brockway's hands."
"How long you been doing this?"
"Long enough to know what I'm doing," he said. "And I learned it without all that education that them what's been sent down here is supposed to have. I learned it by doing it. Them personnel fellas don't want to face the facts, but Liberty Paints wouldn't be worth a plug nickel if they didn't have me here to see that it got a good, strong base. Old man Sparling know it, though. I can't stop laughing over the time when I was down with a touch of pneumonia and they put one of them so-called engineers to pootin' around down here. Why, they started to having so much paint go bad, they didn't know what to do. Paint was bleeding and wrinkling, wouldn't cover or nothing. You know, a man could make himself all kinds of money if he found out what makes paint bleed. Anyway, everything was going bad. Then word got to me that they done put that fellow in my place. And when I got well, I wouldn't come back. Here I've been with him so long and loyal and everything. Shucks. I just sent him word that Lucius Brockway was retiring. Next thing you know, here come the old man. He's so old himself, his chauffeur has to help him up them steep stairs in my place. Come in a puffing and a blowing, says, Lucius, what is here? I hear about you retiring. Well, sir, Mr. Spaulding, sir, I says, I've been pretty sick, as you well know, and I'm getting kinda along in my years, as you well know, and I hear that this here Italian fella you got in my place is doing so good, I thought I might as well take it easy round the house. Why, you'd have thought I'd have done cursed him or something. What kind of talk is that from you, Lucius Brockway, he say, taking it easy round the house when we need you out to the plant? Don't you know the quickest way to die is to retire? Why, that fellow out at the plant don't know a thing about those furnaces. I'm so worried about what he's going to do that he's liable to blow up the plant or something that I took out some extra insurance. He can't do your job, he said. He don't have the touch. We haven't put out a first-class batch of paint since you've been gone. Now, that was the old man himself, Lucius Brockway said.
So what happened, I said.
What you mean, what happened?
He said, looking as though it were the most unreasonable question in the world.
Shucks! A few days later, the old man had me back down here in full control. That engineer got so mad when he found out he had to take orders from me, he quit the next day.
He spat on the floor and laughed.
He was a fool, that's what, a fool. He wanted to boss me, and I know more about this basement than anybody, boilers and everything. I help lay the pipes and everything, and what I mean is I knows the location of each and every pipe and switch and cable and wire and everything else, both in the floors and in the walls and out in the yard. Yes, sir. And what's more, I got it in my head so good I can trace it out on paper down to the last nut and bolt. And ain't never been to nobody's engineering school, neither. Ain't even passed by one, as far as I know. Now, what do you think about that?
I think it's remarkable, I said, thinking, I don't like this old man.
Oh, I wouldn't call it that, he said. It's just that I've been round here so long. I've been studying this machinery for over 25 years. Sure. And that fellow thinking 'cause he'd been to some school and learned how to read a blueprint and how to fire a boiler, he knows more about this plant than Lucius Brockway. That fool couldn't make no engineer 'cause he can't see what's staring him straight in the face. Say, you forgetting to watch them gauges.
I heard over, finding all the needles steady. They're okay, I called.
All right, but I'm warning you to keep an eye on them. You can't forget down here, 'cause if you do, you liable to blow up something. They got all this machinery, but that ain't everything. We, the machines inside the machine. You know the best-selling paint we got, the one that made this here business?
He asked as I helped him fill a vat with a smelly substance. No, I don't.
Our white. Optic white.
Why the white rather than the others?
'Cause we started stressing it from the first. We make the best white paint in the world. I don't give a damn what nobody says. Our white is so white,
You can paint a chunk of coal and you'd have to crack it open with a sledgehammer to prove it wasn't white clear through.
His eyes glinted with humorless conviction, and I had to drop my head to hide my grin.
You notice that sign on the top of the building?
Oh, you can't miss that, I said.
You read the slogan.